Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel's fight to get to 14 nanometers, single-atom transistors that self-destruct, more 8-inch tablets, new GTX 760s, awesome water cooling, and oh yeah, Windows 8.1. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 239, recorded October 17th, 2013. Tiny tablets and shrinking process. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting, pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com. That's twitch.ting.com. This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the best, most useful, most informative, and most important news. And we love to talk about hardware questions, too. My partner in crime, Ryan Shroud, is somewhere in Montreal, and according to his Twitter feed, I understand, is drinking with NVIDIA. I can only imagine what sort of mayhem that will lead to. Joining me today from PCPer.com, Josh Walrath, from somewhere, I believe, in Wyoming, where it is
somewhere.
Somewhere.
It is snowing outside. What is October? And we're nearing the end of it.
Yeah, I always amazes me when like I'm talking to family in Colorado and they're like, it's snowing. I'm like, it's June. You're done. They're like, no, we're not done.
Oh,
my goodness. I'm just getting ready to put on my extra fleece just thinking about it. Windows 8.1 now available. Have you installed it yet, Josh?
I have not. I probably will have to because there's enough under the hood type advancements in file system. Maybe not so much file system, but certainly in the graphics department, 11.2, DirectX 11.2 is in there. They've done some other tweaks. So I would imagine an AMD would probably be quite happy if I were to do this is, get in 8.1, start using in the test rigs for the graphics. And go from there. How is CPU usage versus Windows 7? I mean, they're about the same, or is it a little higher?
Funny.
From what you've noticed.
From what I've noticed, the thing that kind of blows me away is there's been some changes in Windows 8 introduced some changes in memory handling and how things were registered. So all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of people who found out their 1 gigabyte of memory, basically low power, Atom powered. I used to know the name of the little net PCs.
Netbooks?
That's the one. Yeah, it's funny. It's like I own 2. I still have them. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, Windows XP was atrocious on this. And then it got worse and worse and worse. And then actually Windows 8 for a lot of people made them usable again because it was so much more efficient in how it was handling the ridiculously small amount of memory inside of those machines. But overall, I think the CPU handling is really good. The memory handling is improved. The thing I'm kind of actually excited about in Windows 8.1 is device encryption, which is kind of beyond BitLocker, basically encrypting everything that runs through the operating system on the hard drive. Unfortunately, my hardware won't support it because it needs to be. So I need to have connected standby and Windows hardware certification requirements for secure boot. And I'm just like, so the next notebook, maybe, if I'm lucky. We'll see how that goes. I don't know. It's interesting.
Do you use touch at all? You just a mousing guy?
My running joke is that I've been using a Windows 8 laptop and a Windows 8 desktop. And in the office, I pretty much live on this Windows 8 desktop. It's a Lenovo, really nice machine, all in one, big 24, 27 inch monitor. And the longer I have access to touch, the less I use it. Like I used to like, I almost never use it until someone's over my shoulder and we're looking at something and all of a sudden I'm making windows bigger or pulling photos up. And I found that was really fascinating. And it's like, as much as I like the Metro interface on a phone or a tablet, I immediately pretty much dump straight into the desktop environment on a computer. And I can't decide if that's just because, you know, I've been using the Windows desktop for 1,000 years and I'm just not ready for that metaphor, or the fact that going sort of single application full screen is just so profoundly frustrating for me in Metro, because it's just a very inefficient way to use the screen real estate. But yeah, the longer I have access to touchscreens, the less I use it. And I've had some interesting, I was having actually a conversation with Dell about that to see what their kind of response was. And I think at this point, the user base for touchscreens is so small, they don't really know how people are using them or if they are. So have you been, obviously you're not running Windows 8 and Windows, touchscreens of Windows 7 were just awful.
Yes. No, I've messed around with 8 some but they were all in non-touch environments. And so you got to have little, chimes, the corner you got to mouse up to and do multiple things to even turn off the machine. Some of those things obviously could be improved and streamlined. Eventually I'll do it, and I imagine I'll find workarounds for stuff I don't like, just like pretty much any operating system it has done from Windows 3.1 to 95, 98, and above.
I'm just laughing because the chat room slashed by. Duper, there's only one available. Excuse me. That's an insult to Drunken Sailor. They earn the money they spend, and when they run out, they stop spending. So that, of course, being our pre-show conversation about the government trying to kill us all slowly and with great irritation. It's interesting. Have you seen any of the 8-inch Windows tablets that have been coming out?
You know, I haven't looked around for them. I know that they are getting there. Doesn't Lenovo have one, or is it Dell that's pushing this right now?
I want to say Dell. Dell's got a new Windows 8-inch
tablet. That seems really small.
I can't decide if it's perfect because a bunch of people I work with have been using the iPad minis and have completely abandoned their laptops for most usage. But it's Dell's revived the Venue brand. So they have the Venue 8 Pro, which is like an 8.1 tablet, which I got some hands-on time with, not enough to really like benchmark or anything, but it felt snappy. You know, you could do basic work on it. And then Lenovo's got the Mix 2 Windows 8.1 tablet. Actually, PC Per wrote that one up. And that's another one where it's Bay Trail system on a chip, 8.5 by 5.2 by 0.32 inches thick, 350 grams. So they basically weigh nothing. Yeah. 1200 by 800 display, 10-point capacitive multi-touch, front and back cameras, 2 gigs of RAM, not my favorite, 128 gigabyte of eMMC storage, support for micro SD storage, and it's $300, which, you know, is right on the cusp for a lot of people of an affordable toy.
Yeah, if that has a full OS on it, that's...
Yeah.
Not horrific.
No, not at all. And it's been interesting. There's been a couple of manufacturers been playing around with $300 laptops with like 10-inch screens. And I'm trying to decide if there's sort of a low end of the market they're hitting or people that just want super, super portable devices. It's funny because this is going to be so much more functional than anything that was running Windows RT. Because you can run the full range of Windows applications, at least within the restrictions of 2 gigabytes of RAM. And the Bay Trail processor, but they're good looking systems. The build quality is really good. I think that's one of the HP ones right there.
That's HP. And,
it's funny. They're like a thing now. So I'm kind of curious if it's one of those things where a whole bunch of vendors like bought into Microsoft's vision and they built these things and we'll never see them by spring of 2014, or if this is going to be sort of a new alternative to the iPad mini.
Just kind of be a shot in the pan and be like the netbooks that you have. How long do they try to sell those puppies?
They just kind of went out with a whimper, not with a bang, I think.
I think it's pretty fascinating to see where, the CPU guys are going, because for the longest time it was, faster megahertz, faster, 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 better IPC. And then they were kind of hitting a wall in that, we can sort of improve IPC and we can go up more in clock speed, but what's kind of the point? So let's add more cores. So they've, you know, got up to these 8 and 12 core products essentially. And now it's like, where do we go from here? We've got all this performance, all this core, and hardly any software really supports it. So, you know, they looked at the mobile space. It's like, we can, you know, tone everything back down, make it as efficient as possible. And it's just opened up a whole new world in the mobile landscape from, you know, starting with, you know, the first smartphones in, what, 2005? And the ecosystem we have now is it's absolutely amazing, the amount of performance you can get in such small form factors and so cheaply. Yeah. If you had that kind of stuff in 2003 on your desktop, you'd be ecstatic. And now we're just carrying that in front pocket along with other things.
Yeah, I was going to say front pocket or, you know, even more power in a, you know, a freaking sub 1 pound, 8-inch tablet. Yeah. I mean, and that's what's been so funny because it's, you know, I guess it was the 2012 CES, but Intel was like, we want hand gestures, we want eye tracking, we want vocal interaction. It's like what you want is things that justify building more expensive, fast processors because, you know, it's still, it's like, I got to have a Core i7. Well, actually, if you're not rendering a lot of video or doing big engineering drawings, doing huge audio editing or working with, like, you know, bazillions, the biggest possible, you know, raw photos, you probably actually don't need a Core i7. Or, you know, if you're doing gaming on a 4K monitor.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been a really weird thing because, like, traditionally I've always been like, I want it faster, I need it faster. And now I'm like, you know, a Core i5 is really fast for like 90% of what I do.
We're well past the old Pentium 2 260 6 days when that came out for $1,500 and you had to have it because it was damn fast.
I remember 90 meg, a friend of mine edited an entire, it was basically a DOS-based multi-track recording application. This was like 92, 91, and they were using a 90 megahertz Pentium to record this entire album. It was amazing. They recorded it, they mixed it, sounds amazing. It sounded like a, you know, a $200 an hour studio at the time, which was a lot of money. But yeah, that machine wouldn't load most web pages these days.
Not at all.
Oh my goodness. PCs aren't dead yet. Not that we particularly believe the death of the PC, but PC shipments fell less than expected. Tablets grew less. Did you guys talk about this last night on the PC Per podcast, Josh?
A little bit, but I don't think terribly much. Because during this time, I think what AMD announced today their earnings Intel 2 days ago. And yeah, they haven't been dropping as much as a lot of people have feared. And part of that is, you know, you can get a really good computer cheap. You can get an amazingly fast computer for just a little bit more money. Right. Intel came out and they had something like, what, 13 billion dollars in revenue. They made $3 billion in net income. Just, you know, even AMD made a profit this last quarter.
Yes.
Yeah, no kidding. We need competition in multiple places from these guys. So it's, the sky is not falling. People still need PCs. Workplaces still need PCs. And even though the rate of adoption has obviously slowed down, we're still growing in areas like India, China. People in the U.S. will still need new machines to replace those that are older and are broke down. And we still have advancements, especially in graphics still, that people can utilize on a day-to-day basis, not just people who are heavy-duty gamers, people who want to do some basic video editing and have an APU or something that can leverage the extra power that a GPU or onboard GPU can do. This is something that will make a difference in their day-to-day operations. So instead of, you know, back in the great 90s when $3,000 will get you a pretty basic system, you can buy something really nice for $400 and, you know, do everything you kind of need. And so buying a new computer is not nearly the investment it used to be, obviously. And right. so I think that that has also allowed kind of the decline of the growth, decline of growth. That's an oxymoron. But it has slowed the decline of PC sales just because they're so stinking cheap and you can pick one up. And Windows 8, Windows 8.1, touch-enabled stuff, 3D graphics, all these things that still attract people to mm-hmm. new PCs.
Yeah. Yet I feel almost no compulsion to upgrade for my Core i7-920 that I've been running for the last 3 years. I'm almost
you
there.
You people
so close.
Do, almost.
Oh, my goodness. 14-nanometer Broadwell chips have been delayed. Poor yields being blamed. Jeremy wrote this up for PC Per. Delays we first heard about in June. Nice Canadian boy. Still true, Broadwell will not be available until sometime in 2014. This slowdown of their tick-tock strategy has been caused by the high density of defects on wafers, which is driving the yields down on these chips, which not only leads to less profitability, if I'd like to speak English and not gibberish, but also means that supplies will be too low to go to market with.
Yeah, Intel likes to build up their supplies quite a bit before they do anything. I remember, you know, again, back in the Pentium 2 days, they were putting those things in warehouses for about 9 months straight before they actually had released them. And in fact, they released them quicker than they wanted to because the, 440LX chipset that was originally supposed to go with it was not ready yet. But AMD mm-hmm. had released the original K6 chips and had taken the performance crown from the 233 megahertz Pentium MMX. That's what Intel does. I mean, they like to stockpile stuff and then make sure that they have enough to kind of quench that initial demand and then be able to get enough off the line to keep it going. But we've talked extensively at PC Per about process technology. That's kind of one of my little hobbies that I like to pay attention to because it really is very important for the semiconductor industry to have, you know, a pretty solid march of improvements in process technology because we become more power efficient, more performant, more features in pretty much everything we do. Again, allows us to have these amazing mobile parts. But the jumps that everybody else has had from 28 to 22 and 20 nanometer, I mean, nobody's been able to do it. Only Intel is really pushing out products. Well, I mean, only Intel and the flash memory guys, they're at like 19 nanometers. Right. But flash memory is a totally different beast than these complex CPUs, GPUs, you know, any kind of ASICs that that we see in any kind of processing. Mm-hmm. And so really only Intel has been at 22, effectively doing that, and they are going to make the jump to 14 by the end of this year, and it just hasn't been there for them. It's an amazingly complex endeavor to go mm-hmm. to these, you know, sub 20 nanometer geometries. And even the great Intel, who has spent billions and they have a lot of really smart guys working on these problems, they're still having issues. And that doesn't really bode well for the rest of the industry who's trying to get even just a 20 nanometer, right. Much less 14. So, yeah, it's not surprising that this happened. A lot of people were expecting, you know, a pretty significant slowdown. And Intel, I mean, their roadmaps were aggressive, and they have been aggressive. And they've right. done a pretty good job in sticking with them. I mean, TikTok has not exactly been right on schedule. But instead of, you know, 2 years, it's like 2 years and 3 months, you know, 2 years, 4 months. And so it's not a huge delay that we're seeing. And again, we're probably going to see the first of these products hitting late Q1. I mean, mm-hmm. don't nail me down to that, but that kind of right. looks, sounds like when it's going to be. So they're not all that late. It's going to be 3 to 4 months, but still it should be a very, very interesting product. And again, the first one that will be 14 nanometer Tri-Gate based.
Has part of the slowdown or I agree that the engineering problems they're solving are just extraordinary. You know, and it's funny, you look at the Intel R&D pipeline slide on the article page, and it's like 2015 plus 10 nanometer, 7 nanometer, 5 nanometer, you know, and you start getting to the point where you can no longer use copper. You're starting to look at alternative sort of technologies for pushing the
zeros. Well, it's not silicon. It's they're looking at carbon based graphite, buckyballs.
Which starts gets well, it gets like really sci-fi really fast, and the scale.
Yeah, you start dealing with quantum electron tunneling. It just electrons seemingly appearing out of nowhere and activate a transistor, and you've got gibberish going on. It's just, we're hitting some interesting physical walls, and go ahead.
I was going to say is part of what Intel trying to do is sort of end run their way around ARM and the mobile, if they can move the process fast enough, can that help them sort of turn the corner on catching up with AMD and super low power mobile parts? Or is this just all part of overall what Intel needs to do to keep being Intel?
I think a lot of it, they have amazing margins for their products. They're hitting 60% to 65%. Everybody else, they're pretty happy between 36% and 40%. I remember NVIDIA hit 45% and they thought that they're at the top of the world. Intel has not had that problem. I mean, they stay profitable. They invest wisely in their fabs, and their manpower is really second to none in the world. And so that does allow them to get more money out of each product because they can shrink it down, they can have more die per wafer, but still sell them at a much higher price than what the competition can. And the competition is setting their price at where they can really survive. So Intel always has that nice buffer over the competition. And they now do view ARM as their primary competition. AMD is kind of falling to the side. Not nearly as important. I doubt we'll see AMD ever reach 20% of market share again. I think they're like 16 to 17%. And it's pretty doubtful that unless they have something absolutely amazing that we have no idea about, they're going to stay in that area and under 20% while Intel controls the rest. But, of course, the big growth is mobile, and ARM simply owns that area. And part of that is because their design from the ground up was low power, reduced instruction set, just a lot of stuff that gave it good performance for the power envelope that they were aiming at. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone by and they've had access to the smaller process geometries, they've improved in performance, they've enhanced their features, and certainly what they have now is very comparable to the Bay Trail series from Intel. And certainly that is an area where Intel is very, very interested in getting into because it's a big growth industry. And hitting a 14 nanometer part, and the initial Broadwells are all going to be mobile based. I mean, they're all BGA based at first. They may release a regular, type processor for the desktop, but it's all aimed at, extreme mobility, good performance. And they want to rule that land as well. And the easiest way to get there, and I say easy with a grin and a nod and a wink, is by utilizing and leveraging their process technology. Because if you look back at Ottolini, I believe he was the CEO. He kind of really pushed for desktop and server. And those markets started to shrink, and they're like, well, we better catch up on mobile. The initial Atoms were all based on much, much larger geometries and process. Like 45 nanometer, I believe, was one of the first Atom processors out there. And it took them, they didn't update that forever. And then they had a 32 nanometer. And it was going to be, the initial roadmap was they would only get to 22 nanometer in like 2015. But he got, kind of pushed out and retired or whatever you want to call it. New guy came in and, they've really refocused and getting their mobile strategy back to where it needed to be. And so that's why we saw a really quick introduction going from 32 nanometer Atom to the 22 nanometer Bay Trail stuff. I mean, that was like within a year of, you know, the initial 32 nanometer part to what we're seeing now with Bay Trail starting to ship. So yeah, I mean, you know, the sleeping giant has awakened, and the mobile market is a much more interesting place now than it has been in a while. And it was pretty dang interesting in between Samsung, Apple, AMD trying to put in there, Qualcomm being pretty aggressive, NVIDIA. And so, yeah, it's going to get even more cutthroat.
It's you mentioned Apple, and I should bring up that Steve Jobs, the patent held up the Steve Jobs patent on the iPhone, which was anonymously challenged, the 20 patents there in this gigantic 364-page document. I think everybody generally assumes it was anonymously challenged by Samsung and Google. But yes, yeah, the good write-up on Apple Insider. There's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of speculation and commentary on this over the last 9 months. But 9 months after the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issued a tentative first office action invalidating an Apple multi-touch patent credited in part to co-founder Jobs, the body has reversed its initial determination to confirm all claims as patentable, which, and I'm going to oversimplify for the sheer unbridled joy of it, but essentially, one, this means that the strategy employed most likely by Samsung and Google has backfired because it strengthened the patent rather than invalidating it. But it looks like a huge sort of some of the core interesting things in multi-touch have basically been nailed to the floor by Apple. And if you've never read the patent, it's a stunning read, full of just plot twists and excitement. Touchscreen device method and graphical user interface for determining commands by applying heuristics. And it's just basically multi-touch screens and what the iPhone did that nobody else had done to that point in terms of the mobile market. So, man, the mobile market, the sort of Apple-Samsung battles are getting ugly. Yeah. Meanwhile, Apple is still buying chips from Samsung or using Samsung as a fab, which is...
Well, yeah, the Samsung is one of those companies in the world. I mean, I think they produce chips. Mm-hmm. I mean, like massive cargo transports, and right. They do, you know, the most basic products. It's just such a massive, large company, and often the infighting in between divisions is intense. And so, yeah, you've got the screen guys, you know, selling to Apple and whatever. You got the foundry guys wanting to get as much Apple business. But then you got the Samsung, you know, chip design guys who are competing against Apple, and they're both trying to get, you know, chips into other handsets. It's just insane. It's a schizophrenic company, to say the least.
I like what Beatry in the chat room just posted. Patrick, it's called a mutually abusive relationship. except everybody's making a lot of money. Also, it's funny, we were talking about process before. Scott Michaud posted, quote, in 2012, a single atom transistor was fabricated using a phosphorus atom bound to a silicon surface between two significantly larger electrodes. This transistor could be said to be a 180 picometer transistor, the van der Waals radius of a phosphorus atom. And for those of you who, like me, were not up on the picometer measurement, it is 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter, which, to use the vernacular of my native New Jersey, is really damn small.
It is, but the problem is it could handle something like 500 switches, and then it would self-destruct. So
perfect.
Yeah.
It's got to be perfect for something. I don't know. First version of everything always sucks. What's going on with the GTX 760s? There's like two OEM versions coming out, the GTX 760 Ti and the GTX 760 192-bit, which sounds so fast until you realize it's actually the 192-bit is running at 823 megahertz to the base clock of the GTX 760 of 980 megahertz. Both have the same amount of shader cores, and the Ti has more shader cores, but it's still running slower than the base clock on the GTX 760. Did Is this one of those things where NVIDIA just decided to name a couple more GPUs in a way that's going to confuse the marketplace even more while shopping?
Well, there are some issues at NVIDIA with product placement. you've got the Titan at the top end, $999. You got the GTX 780s at around the $650, $600 range. Then you've got the 770s at the $400 range. And then below that, at around $240, is the 760. That's kind of the meat of the market, and they've got no products, while AMD has done a pretty good job in stretching out their products from in between $100 to $300 plus. For example, the R9 280X is $299. It has performance that far outstrips that of the GTX 760, but it's only $40 to $60 more expensive. And when I say outstrips, I mean it is significantly faster. It looks like the new 760s are, again, GK 104 based, which, again, that's the same stinking chip that we saw introduced over a year and a half ago with the GTX 680, GTX 670. They created two more SKUs, one higher than the regular 760, one lower, to kind of fill in the gaps where they can more adequately compete with AMD and their new kind of refreshed lineup of Pitcairn and Tahiti GPUs. And as far as I know, the only information comes from GeForce.com, which is NVIDIA. So I think they broke their own NDA. But again, these are OEM only.
You can't buy them unless you're buying an entire system, unless there's enough. I don't really see there being enough demand for these parts for them to break them out of the OEM silo, but I have been wrong before about GPUs. Valve Steam Controller demo. If you've been excited about the Steam Boxing, certainly we've been talking about them a bunch. Jeff Bellinghausen, the former chief technology officer at Sixth Sense, currently works for Valve with their hardware initiative. And did he do this exclusively for PC Per, the walkthrough?
Oh, no.
Okay. No. I was like, wow.
I know. It would have been quite the coup, but alas, 'tis not the case.
I'm reserving judgment until I get my grubby little paws on one of the actual controllers. I'm really curious to see how the dual thumb pads, which I don't think is actually
thumb pads. Feedback. I'm kind of confused about how that is. You've probably seen that comic of the guy with the controller, and it's got the portal glow around it. Have you seen that comic? It's like, yeah, I can feel the haptic feedback already. It's Gabe Newell sitting shirtless, and he's got some,
Hey, there's, the certain things I don't want to search for, because what has been seen cannot be unseen in goal. I got to say, I've played around with some phones, and I actually, some Android phones where I was getting to use the haptic feedback, and I like it. I'm just not entirely sure how it fits with a game controller. I don't know. It'll be interesting. But yeah, Portal 2, Counter-Strike, Global Offensive were demoed. Right thumb emulates movement of a mouse. Left thumb activates a virtual D-pad. And at the same time, we've seen some interesting startups around turning tablets into customizable controllers. So I can't say if I'm excited, because we haven't had any real advances in controllers in a while, or if I'm going nuts, because and I'll sort of jump ahead in our rundown. There's been another virtual reality system funded on Kickstarter. So let's see, where is it? 1,967 backers, $483,563 pledged of the $400,000 goal, and there's 28 days to go for the Cast AR, the most versatile AR and VR system. 3D holographic-like projections are fully immersive environments in virtual reality. I think these are glasses. They're designed to allow you to have a virtual reality experience while staring through the lenses, but I'm starting to get completely over all of the virching stuff.
Yeah, but they beam the light into your eyes, just kind of like the world reflects light into them. So it looks like it's certainly a unique implementation as compared to the Oculus Rift. Right. Oculus is, you know, very much more traditional, and they've got, you know, two LED screens and, you know, the lens and all that. These are really kind of interesting. I'm curious about the physics and the optics behind them and how well they actually work.
Remember
that stinking, Star Trek, the Next Generation, where they had that game that beamed directly into your eyes and it took control of the Enterprise and everything. But yeah, I mean, it's essentially the same thing. I mean, they're kind of getting away from the middleman, which is LCD screens, and just beaming the images into your eyes. So I think that's kind of cool.
So I have to say, they were here yesterday and I was using them, and they're amazing for being a prototype, actually. They are great.
That's funny. I think actually Veronica got to demo those on Monday's show.
I hate you people. Nobody ever comes and shows us interesting things in Laramie, Wyoming. Nobody.
They do. Yeah, this is not a lot of technology.
Yeah. And so the one other thing I'd like to add is it's very hard to show the experience without actually doing it. You can't really film it. It's a combination of like the projection screen, and you kind of have to do it a little bit in the dark. And yeah.
Wow. I should probably actually apologize to Jerry Oldsworth right now, because Veronica was really excited about these on Monday's episode of Techzilla. Quote, 3D gaming glasses that don't suck. All right. I'll be excited when I get my grubby little eyes on them. Oh, goodness. Meanwhile, I'm going to mention this one just for Mr. Shrout, who a couple of people in chat room have asked. He is in Montreal hanging out with NVIDIA, apparently at a hockey game right now, getting his beer on. But it's funny, Dave Thier wrote up at Forbes, the CEO promises Oculus Rift won't make you sick. And that was the Oculus CEO, Brendan Uribe, talking at the Gaming Insider Summit in San Francisco. So with the newest update to the headset, he says he's finally getting to be able to use it. I was able to stay in it for 45 minutes. He said, usually I can't stay in it for more than 2 minutes. So reducing latency and screen judder apparently were the secrets. And it's interesting.
Thank goodness they got John Carmack on there.
Are you saying that in a serious way or in a snarky way?
No, I mean, the dude understands optics and latency, and he had done a lot of stuff in his game engines to take care of a lot of the negative issues that we see. It's why the Quake series and Doom and whatnot have been kind of the Twitch first-person shooter, because it's very predictable, very low latency. And yeah, these are things that he does very, very well when he looks at code and looks at implementations.
We should take a moment to thank our friends over at Ting, who are sponsoring today's episode of Twitch. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. They're a no BS mobile service. It's pretty simple. You pay for what you use. You don't require a contract. You get the devices in one pooled plan. It's really simple. They're an MNVO, a reseller of the Nationwide Sprint Network. And the deal is, you buy your hardware, they give you the best deal possible on the service. So, you know, basically, man, there's no surprises. They're really simple. I actually have two devices on Ting. I've got a Galaxy Note 2 and a wireless hotspot. And it's really nice, because I used to drop $60 a month in a wireless hotspot, whether I used it for 0 minutes or 0 megabytes, or if I used it for gigabytes. And it's pretty slick, right? You can choose their extra small bundle. You pay a minuscule amount monthly. And if you don't use the data, it rolls over. If you use more data, you don't get slammed with some vicious overage charges. They just drop you up to the next price bucket. So it's pretty manageable. You're not going to get beaten to death because, say, the kids got a little nutty with Netflix while the family was on a road trip. They have a new ETF relief program. If you're basically paying to get out of your old contract to come to Ting, they'll give you a credit for 25% of your ETF up to $75 per device. Just purchase your device through Ting, port your number, then submit your final bill with your detail from your previous carrier. And they've got the information for that up at ting.com/ETF. It's nice. It's really nice. It's really simple. Voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding. It's all part of the service. They're not going to sort of give you like, well, it's going to be $3 a month for voicemail and $35 a month if you want to use it as a hotspot or for tethering. But it's really cool. You know, basically each device on your plan costs $6. If you use a lot of data, you pay more. If you use less data, you essentially pay less. And the customer is really good. I've used it twice. I've had people answer on the phone. They've followed up with email summarizing what we talked about. You can go to help.ting.com, check things in the forums, contact them directly. Really good account management inside the website. And I really like them. You purchase your mobile device from Ting. Should be in your doorstep in 2 to 5 days. Activate your device. You can port your existing phone number. There are a fair amount of Sprint devices because this is a Sprint-based service. They're a reseller of Sprint service that you can port over to Ting. And I got to say, it's good stuff. I use it. I use it every month. I pay the bill every month quite happily. I use it all the time. Twitch.ting.com if you want to support the show and save yourself a whole bunch of money. And by the way, I highly suggest you go check out the savings calculator at the Ting website. You know, the wife's not quite ready to replace her iPhone with an Android device. But if I can get her over that step, we might be able to save a couple grand a year on our cell phone bill, which is astronomical. So do us a favor, visit Ting today at twitch.ting.com. Save money, better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting, and you can save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So twitch.ting.com and start saving today. And we want to thank Ting for supporting This Week in Computer Hardware. And yeah, I just want to say one more time, I'm officially now excited about the AR.
What are you excited about? Would you just tell us what you're excited about? That you're
I'm officially excited about the Cast AR. I'm just frustrated that we keep seeing all of these amazing devices that have new sorts of inner controls and immersive events, but they all never seem to finalize and change. There's just one vomit-inducing helmet after another, but Burke says it's amazing. Veronica says it's amazing. So
watch Triangulation from yesterday on the twit.tv network. We talked to Jerry. We tried to show you the product being demoed for more than an hour.
There you have it. Anybody vomit while they were there? Burke? No. Burke says no. That may be the strongest argument for it of all. XSPC Race Storm 750 EX240 water cooling, Wally cooling kit.
Waller cooling.
Overclock your Wally water cooling kit. That was written up on PC Per this week. Good, bad, or indifferent. Morris seemed very excited about this one.
He did. He liked it. It's a big cooler. It's got two fans. You know, dense radiator. The build quality is actually quite nice. They have the entire kit. Yeah, I mean, it's all anodized metal. Mm-hmm. The reservoir is nice and big. It's got the, I think it's LED lit through several parts. Again, it's, you know, well built, well designed. It fit in a multitude of cases, and it performed very, very well. It is a higher end product as compared to the self-contained liquid cooling that we see from Corsair, Antec, others. And so you're going to pay a little bit more from this, and it's going to require maintenance as compared to those self-contained units, but you're going to get probably a longer lifespan out of it. Going to have probably better cooling because you've got a much larger reservoir than those other products. So, I mean, you can sink a whole lot more heat into it than you can with these other self-contained units. So I'm not entirely sure how much it cost offhand. I didn't read all of it because I'm winging it. Like I said, I can do that with the best. But yeah, we talked about it last night, and it's a nice, nice product. But you're going to pay for having that.
It's not, I mean, it's not too vicious. I paid almost as much for a walk without a radiator or any plumbing a few years ago. But $150, it's not that much more expensive than some of the fancier Corsair Hydro series. Because I think like the H110 is like up to like $130 now. I will say the thing I like so much about the self-contained or the pre-assembled kits is never having to worry about getting any kind of antifreeze or water on my motherboard again. That can get
don't
really
worry about
expensive.
The stains, but you certainly do worry about booting it up for the first time and discovering you've got a leak and some really interesting crackling sounds coming from your computer.
Why is the magic smoke leaking out?
The magic smoke.
We got a couple of questions from the chat room to kind of wrap up the show today. Weebs says, Patrick, is the Mac Pro form factor the future of PCs? Josh, are you feeling the hollow tube full of Mac joy that offers almost no internal expansion?
Do you remember the Mac tissue paper dispenser? That's kind of what it reminds me of. I mean, it's an interesting design, and thermally it makes sense, but expansion wise not so much. But yeah, it's still going to have what, two Fire Pros in there at max, so I'm kind of curious what kind of heat does come out of that puppy. It's going to be an interesting design. And what, a couple of days after that was announced, and what, D-Link had one of their vertical cylinder routers that, of course, it looks kind of strange when I do this. And yeah, let's not go there.
Let it go.
The form factor of the future.
Well, if you're thinking about physics, right, it works. There's a reason cooling towers at nuclear plants are designed that way, right? Yeah. You got your Venturi, the air comes up, everything's good, heat should go out, power supply should be at the top of the computer, yada, yada, yada. But man, it's a tough, you know, everybody I know, and there's a lot of people in this building that have been running Mac Pros because of the video editing that we do here. They look at that and they're like, that's nice. Where am I going to put my hard drives? And suddenly you've got, there was a picture somewhere on the web where it was like a Mac Pro and the new Mac Pro with, you know, basically a bunch of Thunderbolt expansion chassis to basically make up for the lack of expansion inside of the new Mac Pro. It looks beautiful. I mean, it's from a physics standpoint, it makes sense. It looks beautiful. You know, I like watching Apple advance, or anybody for that matter, advance kind of design. But, you know, most of the people who are spending all of the money for a Mac Pro need like six hard drives, or they need, you know what I mean? It's just, I'm just thinking they're kind of missing a big chunk of their market. Or I'm just obsessed with storage because we edit video here and, you know, we fill terabyte drive.
Well, you know, guys willing to pay that amount won't really mind the extra amount paid for that whole 6-port Thunderbolt caddy that's, you know, another $2,000 to $3,000. It's pocket change. Pocket change for these people.
I like what Old Geezer says. Hard drives get duct taped to the outside of the units. Oh, there it is. Let me put the, from the chat room, we also have the picture, the terrible, cruel picture of the Mac Pro expansion.
That's unfortunately true.
Oops. Oh, and Uncle Big Android says, Patrick, I just did take an H50 out of a machine that ran for 3 years and finally had a radiator leak. I wonder what caused that. And Duper says, are those AMD cards, the new Mac Pro, any good for gaming? Kind of.
Essentially, what, HD 7970s? So
I was going to say.
But we don't know how well Crossfire works in Mac OS.
Yeah, and I'm not.
You're not going to pay that kind of money to game. Mac gaming.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Banzai says, Patrick, they're just planning on everybody using an obscenely expensive SAN or NAS, which would make sense if Apple was actually still in the SAN or NAS business, but they basically walked away from enterprise support, stomped away from enterprise support, utterly abandoned enterprise support. I think they're more into the sort of lone user with a giant stack of hard drives, although maybe the lone users are going to have giant SANs in the back of their homes in the near future. Interesting thoughts. No.
It's thumbsticks, really big thumbsticks.
And on that note, anything exciting coming up on PC Per this week that you can talk about? Or is it...
Oh, geez. I've got a... actually, oddly enough, I do have a process feature coming up talking about how that has affected GPU performance and why we're not seeing, you know, the aggressive architectural shifts that we really have been seeing for the past 20 years. And those are coming to seemingly a screeching halt. So I'll be doing that. I think we've got some of the new R9 280Xs cards, R9 270X as well. We'll be working on those, some CPU reviews. Ryan's, again, in Montreal. Some interesting stuff could be talked about tomorrow, so you'll really need to tune in. I can't say a word, and in fact, I don't really know, but Ryan's excited about it, and pretty much everybody who's anybody is in Montreal, which is, explains why you and I are not.
Are holding down the fort.
Yeah.
You're from Wyoming, me in San Francisco. Oh, my goodness. Oh, man. Yeah, we just did the Sonos Play 1 review, came up on Techzilla yesterday. We are having some fun, actually, with Windows 8.1. We're going to do sort of our survival guide and get our hands onto some of the new features after I've run the final version for a few days. It's actually my exciting task after we finish recording the podcast is to get 8.1 running on my system, hopefully without doing any permanent emotional damage. I've gotten pretty good about remembering to back stuff up. And... yeah, at this point, I'm also kind of waiting to see for the iPad to be coming up in the next week or so, because I'm almost ready. I do a lot of navigation with the iPad, and I'm almost ready for a new iPad. Almost.
You know, we had about a month in the summertime where nothing went on because the spring was insane, and then like nothing. And now it's just ramping.
Flooding again.
Yes.
Because... they want us to buy everything for the Christmas.
Buy all the things.
And then get bludgeoned half to death at CES. Yes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, and Techzilla is going to SEMA this year. So we're going to do the CES for call, which I am very, very excited about.
Nice.
Because I like cars and trucks that go fast and cars that go faster and tires. Oh, my goodness. The tire vendors at SEMA will frighten you. And... I can't even explain to you. Tire vendors you've never heard of from countries that are about the size of, you know, I don't know, Vermont. With gigantic booths full of tires. It gets a little surreal. And on that bright and slightly surreal note, I want to thank Josh for stepping in to fill in for Ryan. For Ryan, who is in Montreal, and go to PCPer.com tomorrow morning, or I should say Friday morning, to find out hopefully what's going on with NVIDIA up in Montreal today.
And it's really stinking early. It's like 8 o'clock mountain time, 7 o'clock. You don't even wake up until 8:30.
Maybe it's going to be a bad announcement. So they're getting everybody racked up at the hockey game and getting their beer on so they can sort of be half conscious as the major announcements are done tomorrow morning.
All right.
Thanks again, Josh. And thanks for having me. Oh, it's my pleasure, man. As always, thanks again to the chat for hanging out with us. And remember, if this is your first Twitch podcast, go over to twit.tv/Twitch to find all of our podcast information on how to subscribe. And if you want to email us, email twitch@twit.tv. And we're going to have more of the regular viewer questions on the show next week. Thanks again. I'm Patrick Norton, and we'll see you next week on Twitch.